Hello and welcome to Coin Talk. Very special episode this week. Crypto's back, baby. And it wouldn't be a bull market without our friend Ledger Status. But the real reason I called Ledger is not actually that it's the bull market part. He is a fun dude to party with when the market's up. But everyone has been crying about market manipulation. We've got our first $1,000 candle of the season. And I feel like this is a good time for like a TA gut check. How do markets basically work? I feel like one element that has been lacking in my crypto education is people will be like, this is market manipulation. This isn't market manipulation. But no one has given me any sort of a definition about what the line between a market and a manipulated market is. So hopefully Ledger can get into some of these topics with us. We're brought to you by Medium. Medium has tons and tons of great writing about crypto. I actually believe anecdotally in my own like feed of Medium stuff, you can basically see more articles get written as the price of Bitcoin rises, which makes this a great time to read about crypto on Medium. If you're enjoying it, become a member. It's $5 a month. All right, let's hear that music.
This episode of Coin Talk was taped Monday, May 20th at 11 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. The Bitcoin price index was $7,751.
Ledger, hello.
What's up, Aaron? It's great to be back.
I don't even know how long it's been. It's been a long winter, however long it was.
Yeah, I wish I would have gone and listened back to the last episode I was on to see if I was right about whatever I said at the time.
Well, you said that you listened to our episode from last week, me and Jay's. Jay's out this week. He'll be back. But shouts to me and Jay's predictions from last week. I believe that we called several of the things that happened over the last week.
Yeah, in the first 5 minutes of that episode, y'all were like, we don't really know what's going to happen next, but maybe this or maybe this or maybe this. And all of them happened.
Yeah, I think it was like 8,000. Like massive crash, $1,000 candle, some combination of that parlay bet hit.
Yeah, basically you were predicting a significant amount of volatility and you didn't know if you were going to, because I think we were around 7 something and you didn't know if we were going to end up at 8K something or 6K something or have some $1,000 candle, and all three things happened. And of course, one of them, the huge down candle with a big wick, was what we're going to talk about a little bit today. But
yeah,
I mean, we're in this point of enormous volatility.
And there's been a big up candle too, right? Like there was also a massive up candle somewhere in there, right?
Yeah. So the big point technically that the whole market was watching was around 6,400.
Yeah.
Because you would have thought it was going to be an enormous point of resistance because it was kind of the center line of where we congregated basically this latter half of 2018, almost the whole year. So the idea was that if we get to 6,400, it's the most obvious short in the world and it'll be really hard to get through it and, you know, sell all your Bitcoin then, et cetera. And then we just drove through it like butter. I mean, it was basically like nothing. And that set up a classic short squeeze. I'd been talking a little bit going into that range that it was sentiment-wise, it was really setting up well for a possible short squeeze right through it because there were a lot of people short. There were a lot of people that were afraid because they didn't get into the market sooner. So they were like, I'll just wait until, you know, we come back down from 6,400. All these sentiment things that fit really well.
So that's kind of like moving bus FOMO. Like you start seeing the jet take off and that like juices you to like buy into the rally.
Yeah, that and also people trying to counter it. So, you know, there's sources on derivatives exchanges like Deribit and BitMEX. If shorts have to pay for the privilege, it makes it more likely for them to get squeezed. If on Bitfinex, if there are more people short than long, it makes them ripe to be squeezed. On CME, the regulated exchange, almost everyone was short. So like everybody was short going into that level. And typically in markets, they're not very kind to that. So I was really suspect that we'd stop at 6,400 and I predicted that we might hit 68 to 72. I felt like a crazy person saying that, Aaron. So if you would have told me we would have gone to 82 to 8,400 at the top, I was in full disbelief mode by the time we got above 7K. So of course we squeezed everyone. It would have been extraordinarily hard.
I want to pause you there. because this is something, generally I'm like, TA proven wrong for reasons I don't understand. And it's not really being proven wrong. There was some percentage chance that it was going to keep going up there. And, you know, everyone's weighing it. But knowing that your mind was like 6,800 and then it runs up to 8,200, looking back, are you able to see like any sort of a way to understand why that happened, or like, do you have any explanation for it?
Yeah. So the reason I thought 68 to 72 is because it was just the short squeeze. Like, and then you kind of go back and settle in either just above 6,400 or maybe on the longer dated, like weekly or monthly chart, maybe that ends up looking like a wick and you do range back below 6,400 and we range, you know, 5 to 6K for a long time before you have a more thorough breakup. That was the, this is just a short squeeze type of move. Where we ended up stopping was almost to the dollar. I know you guys are skeptical about TA.
I'm not really skeptical. I'm just like, I cheer for every side. I like it when everyone wins.
So on the weekly chart, the two prices that kind of set the upper boundaries for that 2018 consolidation, the summer of 2018, around 8,200, just over 8,200, that was where we had a weekly close. And those are really probably the most significant levels to consider. So the weekly close was at 8,200, and that's sure enough where we ended up closing exactly on the previous weekly that we just had. So that's where we finally did stop after 6,400, which was the top of the range in July. The next one, if it was to go further, which is possible, this could extend further, was 9,600, and that was the weekly close from April 2018. So you just look at those prior levels as the ones that you could run into.
Well, I think I called my shot on the show already, which is I think I called 10,000 by June 1st.
You did. And I think that it's possible, but I personally think it's the less likely scenario.
So I said that in a completely uneducated way, just that my general ballpark, like next move, so you're saying is 9,600, little continuation, maybe a few exchanges hit the 10K there as the rally dissolves. But one thing I haven't understood very well in my ongoing crypto education, and it's going to come into play as we discuss this big crash that happened after 8,200, which is, like, I'm a hodler now. I just basically hodl the Bitcoin I already have and the altcoins I already have. So really, I don't actually behave any differently based on where the market is. I'm just in a hold position. What percentage of the Bitcoin market is people who are either just holding or have some sort of like a prefigured position, like I'm going to hold until I double my money and then sell or something, versus people who are doing shorting, sort of riding it up and down, making leveraged bets, all of these kind of I'm trying to profit in both directions kind of activities?
Yeah, so I don't actually remember the exact flow. But there's this concept of what's the float for an asset, right?
Right.
So what percentage is actively being traded? And for Bitcoin, it's quite high. So of the total market cap, whatever the daily volume is, that's the amount of Bitcoin that's being actively traded as a percentage. I would say it's probably pretty high for Bitcoin.
Yeah.
But it just kind of depends on the time. So we have these periods where it's compressing and the volume and the volatility is low, and then it spikes all at once. All this stuff is psychology on a chart. So like you saying, this is what I feel, that's really not different than me saying, this is what I see on a chart. They're the same thing. I'm just trying to read the
tea leaves. I'm just using data and you're using nothing. That's what you're saying to me.
Yeah, I'm trying to make sense of that psychology via the chart.
Via data. And I know that the data that informs your opinion that I'm usually the most ignorant of is volume. And with this big crash that happened, so let's just tell for people who are listening at home, we get up to what, 8,200? 8,400 maybe-ish. Mm-hmm. And then out of nowhere, there's this massive crash that I think didn't bottom out on some exchanges till like 6,400 or 6,500.
It depends on the exchange. I like BitMEX the best because it literally wicked right to 6375, 6400, basically right to like a retest, if you will, of you know, the area that we broke through so strongly.
And in doing so, so explain briefly how these shorts are handled in terms of like what exchange's number is used in wrecking a short and how that plays into this.
Yeah, so an exchange like BitMEX, they have a kind of a mark price. So the derivative XBT that you trade on BitMEX, it trades all by itself.
What's all this XBT stuff versus BTC stuff? Come
it's
on,
just
guys.
It's just a ticker that's used. But yeah, so it's trading on its own. At the same time, it's trying to make sure it doesn't get too out of whack with the regular market, like your cash exchange type of market. So they have a mark price, which is made up of other exchanges' average price. And right now, at the time of this shenanigan, Bitstamp and Coinbase blended were their mark price. So that's what they're trying to peg with BitMEX's incentives.
And they're trying to choose some of the bigger, more liquid exchanges so that you don't see extreme volatility.
Basically the best ones they have available.
Yeah. I mean, it's like sort of like in Blockfolio, you can set it to like global average price. And I don't know how they calculate the Blockfolio global average, but basically this price is like a prestige exchange's price.
Yeah, and they're trying to basically peg that. And the incentives that they offer for people longing or shorting are trying to make it to where it pushes the price back towards the mark.
Right.
So if BitMEX is way off in one direction, then they're going to make people that are forcing it in that direction pay for the privilege of doing it. So therefore, their longs are paying shorts or shorts are paying long. All that is trying to convince people to get the price of BitMEX back to the mark price. So what happens is the algorithms can be gamed if the underlying exchanges, something crazy happens. And because the volume on BitMEX is higher than any of these underlying exchanges, you therefore have to spend less money on the underlying exchange to then have an outsized effect on BitMEX.
Right.
So what happened with the Bitstamp thing is someone put thousands of Bitcoin for sale on market.
Yeah.
So they just basically tossed it out there and were like, hey, come get these cheap Bitcoin. Because if they wanted to sell it for the actual value of those Bitcoins, they could have sold them OTC. They could have sold them over time. They could have done all sorts of things.
Yeah. Can we talk about that for a second? So I think the order was 5,000 Bitcoin.
Yeah. I saw 3,200 at one point, but I think it might have been 5,000 overall.
Okay. So that's even more to my point. Okay. So I'm going to do some back of the envelope math here. What is 3,200 Bitcoin in U.S. dollars right now?
Well, 5,000 is 40 million. 3,200 is around 25 million.
Okay, let's call it between 25 and 50 million dollars worth of Bitcoin was enough to wipe 10 or 20% of the total value of Bitcoin off the board, not using some sort of advanced algorithmic multi-pronged attack, but simply by putting a market order into Bitstamp. And basically, my understanding is if you put in a 3,200 Bitcoin market order, it just keeps filling it. So first you're filling it with the highest bids, and then you keep filling with lower and lower bids, and Bitcoin just rides you down the mountain until you run out of Bitcoin to sell.
Or new people come in to gobble that up.
And is that what stopped it? That new buy bids? People are like, holy shit, you can buy really cheap Bitcoin here. We're going to start buying it.
A lot of exchanges have rules that they put in place to prevent the market from going to zero falsely. Mm. So some exchanges will straight up stop trading. Like CME, if Bitcoin went down more than whatever, like 10% over a certain small period of time, it would just halt trading to allow the order books to fill back up.
Right. 'Cause
what happens is you empty them out and now there's this gaping hole. So your spread becomes really large and it becomes really challenging. Bitstamp did some stuff, but basically what happened is it took several minutes to fill an order that theoretically could have been filled in seconds.
Right.
So it created several minutes of market pressure because of their rules that they have in place that are systematic to try to prevent the market from going to zero, but it also helped prolong the effect of these people trying to sell Bitcoin.
Okay, so I'm going to be the dumbest detective in the room here.
Yeah.
Why did that person sell all of that Bitcoin and both drive down the price of Bitcoin on Bitstamp and in the doing so affect the average price that was reflected on BitMEX, and then thus a bunch of shorts were wrecked?
Yeah, so the...
Sorry, a bunch of longs were wrecked.
A bunch of longs were wrecked.
Yeah.
There's several things here that can be at play, and it's not without risk for someone that's taking part in this. And to go ahead and get it out of the way, in my opinion, this was absolutely coordinated manipulation.
Okay.
But it's not...
I thought you were going to be like, to get it out of the way, that was me who sold the Bitcoin.
No, just for everyone's, you know, safekeeping, I do not have thousands of Bitcoin. All right, so let's do the game theory of what happened.
Yeah.
This was not without risk for whoever took part in it, but it was, to them, probably worth the risk. And there's probably very little regulatory concern for them doing it on the Bitcoin market. Now, if they went and did this on a much more regulated market, it might have been more legal trouble for them, but it's probably not in the Bitcoin market. Other than the fact that CME also uses Bitstamp as one of its index exchanges, and Bitstamp recently got a bit license from the state of New York. So Bitstamp may have to provide some forensics to authorities, et cetera. But whoever did this was probably not within the realm of the United States regulator's long arm.
Let me ask a question here. We've been hearing for years about this Bitcoin ETF. And yeah, the most recent narrative about it is there can't be a Bitcoin ETF until these market manipulation hijinks get curtailed. Is this the kind of market hijinks that would be unacceptable if there was a Bitcoin ETF?
Unacceptable is a strong word, but it doesn't make the case stronger.
Okay.
For the Bitcoin ETF. I would argue all markets are manipulated. You know, our own Donald Trump says stuff like, you know, the stock market looks like a great buy here. or China trade talks are going really well.
Right.
That is very clear market manipulation as well, because they could have talks falling apart and the market's down 2% and they're salvaging it by saying, yeah, the talks are, you know, going right, fine, blah, blah, blah.
But if I took a traditional market, okay, so the Bitcoin market cap, and I want to talk about Bitcoin and altcoins later, but the Bitcoin market cap is what, 200 and some odd billion, $230 billion? Like
no, you're putting another big pump in there. I think it's around 140 billion.
140, right? Okay, no, sorry. I think the overall market cap is 230. So Bitcoin is about 130 million. So if I took a different market for some sort of an asset that's approximately the size of the Bitcoin market, I have no idea. Like, can you think of an example of a 100 billion-ish market?
Not off the top of my head. Let's say silver.
Yeah, let's say like bronze, maybe.
Yeah,
I think silver might be generous.
I think Bitcoin might be bigger than bronze, but
so if I go in the bronze market and I figure out that the price of bronze is a mixture of several bronze exchanges, and I find the most vulnerable one and put in like a mega whale bronze sell order that I ride down, would that be a crime? Like, would that be like, what crime is that if it was one?
Yes, I think it could be a significant crime. It would be something that could put you at risk. And the legislators put out fines to participants on CME's markets if they manipulate markets. So people get fined for trading corn futures the wrong way.
Got it.
Or in a way that manipulates market. So yes, crime, but punishable by fines, probably,
yeah,
typically.
Yeah, it's a giant air quotes crime.
Yeah, and they have various rights and, you know, licenses to trade on particular places.
Yeah.
So anyway.
It's a penalty. It's like, yes, is pass interference a penalty? Yes. Is it a crime? Well, no, it happens all the time. And, you know, you lose a few yards, you keep doing it.
Right. Stuff happens, but it might not be good, but it still happens. And it still happens on regular markets as well. So there may have been consequences for this if this was just like any other market, but there probably won't be for anyone participating. Now let's get back to why this was a good
game theory.
Game theory.
So why was this a good plan?
I don't know the exact volume that day, but I'm going to reference the volume going on over the last 24 hours. So BitMEX's volume over the last 24 hours was greater than $5 billion. Bitstamp was more like $110 million. So now you can take that 24-hour volume and then consider what does it take to adjust the market on Bitstamp. And by that metric, you can spend a smallish amount of money, say $25 to $50 million, on Bitstamp and affect the market in a big enough way. And because Bitstamp is the underlying mark price peg for BitMEX, you can spend that $25 to $50 million on Bitstamp and have an outsized effect on an exchange like BitMEX, which has many, many times that volume traded on their exchange.
Yeah.
So the person could have known that, hey, I'm going to go toss this Bitcoin for sale on Bitstamp. They're not trying to get the best price. If they were trying to get the best price, they would have tried to sell it OTC. They would have sold it over time with what's called like, you know, like something like an iceberg order, where it's just an automated hammer the market every 10 minutes or something like that.
Well, and then even more like simpleton way, they could have sold it on multiple exchanges so they weren't writing a single order book all the way down.
Yes. Your average market participant wants to trade without affecting the market because you're creating slippage for yourself if you're just tossing it all on one. They wanted to do what they did. So you could assume that this same participant, they were on the way down, they probably were on an exchange like BitMEX and saying, I'm going to be short. So they're simultaneously selling their Bitcoin on Bitstamp while they're in an established short position on BitMEX. And then they are using the fact that BitMEX is a highly leveraged exchange. And what happens there is people are over-leveraged. In fact, in April, Arthur Hayes said the average participant on BitMEX was trading 22x. So they were trading 22 times the underlying equity that they were putting up. And you can trade up to 100x on BitMEX. That's what people talk about, right?
Yeah.
But 1x would be saying, okay, well, I have $8,000 on BitMEX, and therefore I'm going to go long $8,000 worth. 22x means you're going 22x times that. And what happens if it goes, say you're 10x, if the price of Bitcoin changes 10%, then you've actually changed 100%. So if it goes against you 10%, you lost all your money.
If I read you correctly, like to me, it seemed illogical to spend that much money to bring down the price of Bitcoin that much because you're like losing a lot of money on that Bitcoin. However, if you make a parallel bet, say of the same amount of money, but leveraged 100x. So anyone's allowed to go 100x leveraged on BitMEX?
Yeah, but you're going to lose your money. The people doing this did not go 100x.
This is like huffing pure gasoline to be yes. going 100x. But I see what you're saying. If you stake the same amount of money in both pools and you lose money on pool A and you gain money on pool B, the pool B winnings are leveraged, so they're way bigger than the pool A.
Yes, if they use the same amount of money. I don't know what someone would have used, what the right calculation would be.
None of this is an advice. In fact, it's explicitly not advice. Don't try this.
And no one can afford this anyway except for people that have at least that $50 million.
If you're listening to this podcast, you can't afford it.
Correct.
We don't have a single listener who has this much money. I don't believe
so. What they would have done was they would have participated in this on both sides because they knew the amount of volume that they had to dump on Bitstamp to affect the price in the first place. So why not be short on the other exchange while you're market dumping thousands of Bitcoin on Bitstamp? And then the other thing that they likely did was they had bids way down on BitMEX. Because this was leveraged on BitMEX, someone could presume, because this happens a lot, that when you dump stuff, you're triggering a lot of liquidations and a lot of stops, and then the wicks on the derivative exchange end up longer than the wicks on most of the regular exchanges. So because the market was so over-levered, you are basically forcing that exchange down further than others, they probably had bids estimating the effect that they're dumping on Bitstamp, estimating the effect that that would have on BitMEX. They probably had bids all the way down in order to long on BitMEX. And because BitMEX is, whatever I said, like 20 times the volume, they could probably fill for much, much, much more than the 25 to 50 million they dumped on Bitstamp. So they're like triple dipping, right? Because they're selling on Bitstamp, they're shorting on BitMEX, and then after the dump, they're closing those shorts and longing on BitMEX. So they're fully taking advantage of the whipsaw, and because such a much smaller amount of the volume is on the underlying exchanges, it makes it more ripe to participate in this manipulation. Whereas, let's say, for example, it was cheaper to, or the volume was 10 times on Bitstamp what it is on BitMEX, you could never have this outsized effect because Bitstamp would be able to absorb the weight of your dump and it wouldn't have that outsized effect on BitMEX. So this is absolutely a symptom of the derivatives exchanges being so much larger than the underlying cash markets.
Okay, and so that kind of was, I guess, brings us back to what my initial question was. So it feels to me like an event like this confirms how much the leveraged, made-up money traded at made-up leverages can control this market. As someone who's holding Bitcoin, did this give you any pause? Like, does this freak you out at all that it's this easy to create a artificial $1,000 candle? I'm putting air quotes around artificial, but...
No, and I would argue that it's not artificial. It's just immature. Bitcoin is not as mature of a market as, say, the NASDAQ, right? Or whatever you... Or oil.
Yeah.
But these things happen all the time in other markets. I don't know if you remember, there was this... famous, the guy, the rogue wave guy that was an options short seller in the oil and natural gas markets. And there was this like guaranteed trade that worked for a long time on a pairs trade between oil and natural gas. And then it just blew up in everyone's face that was participating in it. And that was absolutely a manipulated move in a similar fashion. And what happens is once something starts unwinding, it just all falls apart, right? Like you make money, you make money, you make money, you make money for a long time, and then you die.
Right.
That's what can happen sometimes in these types of scenarios.
So in the scenario of this guy, if he had lost the bet, it would have been because he failed to bring the market down far enough to wreck those longs?
Well, in the oil market, it might have been structured differently.
No, like, no, I meant this guy in our scenario on Bitstamp.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
What, like, how would have he failed? Like, if he had tried to shoot the moon and gotten, like, fallen short, what does that scenario look like?
Their risk was to be selling Bitcoin for under market value and not get away with it. So they don't move the market as much as they calculated they could. And therefore, they didn't get as good of a sell price.
Their behavior ends up looking like a panic sell, basically. Like they're driving the market down and selling simultaneously.
Right. But it's probably not the biggest risk in the world because they probably bought those Bitcoins sometime when it was like sub 5,000. So they were still going to make US dollars on them, but they wouldn't have gotten the best price that they could on the sell itself.
Got it.
And it was worth that risk, I would presume, to them. And I have to reiterate, this is me speculating, game theory.
This is, we've got our Reddit t-shirts on. We're just spinning a few conspiracy theories amongst friends here. But if this person, he, she, or bot, this is a pretty great robot trade, actually. Like, if you could program AI to see opportunities like this across exchanges and just pull the trigger on them, it's a good robot you got there.
Well, your robot has to have quite a heavy war chest in order to pull it off.
Well, the robot's been like algorithmically trading in the background for like 10 years, let's say. And it's just finally ready for its biggest move yet. So it makes this move, right? And it succeeds. It gets down far enough. What do you think the payout was for the person who did this?
I mean, it all depends on how much they were bidding on BitMEX.
Right.
or other exchanges.
Let's say they were equal bets. Let's say Bitstamp and BitMEX had the same war chests. What do you think the upside? So we know that the downside was that they sold their Bitcoin for like at the lowest, like 6,500 or something like that. What do you think the upside of the positive pool money was?
Let's see. Let's say, what was the total size of that? Let's say $1,000.
Yeah, I think 1,000. It was a couple little moves there.
Let's say it was $1,000. And let's say that they put the same amount of Bitcoin on their bids as they did on their on Bitstamp. So 5,000 Bitcoin. Let's say that their leverage was 5x. And let's say that they played it both directions, both short-sided and long-sided. So your $1,000 candle times 5,000 Bitcoin times 5x leverage times twice playing it both down and up would be $50 million. So keep in mind, they didn't lose $50 million on Bitstamp. They sold $50 million worth.
Yeah.
So their slippage was probably some, 10% of
10
that
or
50 million.
10 to 15 at the tops, yeah.
Yeah, so maybe they spent, if you will, in slippage on Bitstamp, $5 or $10 million. And in this scenario, getting a $1,000 candle and, 5,000 Bitcoin worth, but it was probably more than that.
Right.
Because they would have used, the liquidity on BitMEX is high, so you could probably spend more money.
Well,
that would have been upwards of $50 million of profit.
Yeah. See, this is what's slightly disturbing to me about these scenarios is, so you wonder, okay, well, how did this person get 5,000 Bitcoin in the first place? Well, they were probably like pulling moves like this when Bitcoin was under $1,000 and have like been building up a war chest. That war chest just got even bigger with this play. So now we know that this person has $50 million plus to play with to do a similar move. Like, the Bitcoin market gets more mature and it takes more money to do something like this, but it seems like the people who are into manipulating the Bitcoin market are richer than ever.
I think there's many people and organizations that could have done something like this. There's more people or more organizations that have access to thousands of Bitcoin than you might think. It's not just like a couple of like OG crypto people on Twitter.
Not like, just the North Korean government.
There are governments, there are other exchanges. If you really wanted to get into conspiracy theories...
I like that one.
If you really wanted to get into conspiracy theories, you could say, what if Bitfinex or Binance Management were the ones that were playing shenanigans Bitstamp and BitMEX?
And Binance needed a little cash infusion there, too.
Well, I think Binance has plenty of cash, but say what they wanted to make up their $40 million deficit.
Yeah, but you know how it is. You take an L... You just want to like pop back up hard. You're like, you guys, I haven't planned to get back all that money and then some.
We're gonna get some evil mail. I am not saying it's either
of
them. Well,
we already know that CZ listens to this show. He knew about us calling him the Zuckerberg of crypto. So
I'm not saying this was CZ. I think CZ, in fact, would have been disincentivized to do this. But anyway, it could be an exchange. It could be anyone with that initial whatever $50 million, $100 million worth of capital. A lot of people have that type of money. The people that I don't think it would have been would be people with exposure to American regulatory bodies. So because they would know, hey, Bitstamp has a BitLicense, Bitstamp wants to participate in the US. Someone is KYC'd over at Bitstamp to have made that move. So it was probably somebody that was at least comfortable enough to take that exposure on Bitstamp, and then you could never prove it was them on any of those other exchanges. I doubt BitMEX is exactly going to open up their customer information for the authorities to say that someone was on the other side of that. So,
is there like reporting out there or any sort of like blockchain analysis that tries to figure out like who are these whales who are like making big moves like this? Will we ever know who sold those 5,000 Bitcoin?
Probably not publicly, no. I mean, Bitstamp executives probably have a pretty good idea, at least who was the person that technically sold them, because they know the account. Therefore, the state of New York and the CFTC will probably know that individual as well. if that individual is accessible, then maybe they'll have an interview with those bodies. But this is all just speculation on why someone would have been incentivized to do that. Because the reality is, unless someone was panic selling, they did have no reason to do it other than to participate in some kind of shenanigan like we were talking. So that's my theory.
I was already going to bring up how this gives me a queasy feeling about the exchanges before you even brought up the idea of exchanges trading on other exchanges, which we know from the Quadriga case and Bitfinex and many other examples happens. We know that people running exchanges keep money on other exchanges. It seems like the power it gives an exchange like Bitstamp, which isn't even one of the biggest exchanges, right? Like Bitstamp's not a top five exchange, is it?
They're one of the, what the Bitwise report would have called the 10 real exchanges in the world.
Okay.
Like, you know, there's a difference between top exchange and real exchange.
Right. Okay, good point. Well, so it gives an exchange like Bitstamp that has an ability to influence BitMEX prices, the ability, like they could have looked at this situation, seen that order and been like, no, stop, we're stopping trading. Like,
no, exchanges have to be really cautious. Exchanges are like super libertarian.
Well, no, I'm not saying that they should have done that. I'm saying that if they had an interest, like let's say they had $50 million in longs going on BitMEX leverage or something like that, we already know that people are moving money across these exchanges. So I guess I just feel like since exchanges themselves have positions, it seems crazy that one exchange can so deeply influence the outcome of those shorts and longs, which we now know are a huge part of the Bitcoin market.
Yeah, I would say for exchanges, they would not want to trade on their own exchange because there's a lot of ethics issues that come into this. And the legitimate exchanges, and I'm going to say, I think Bitstamp is an exchange with a great reputation and probably pretty good people at it. And I have no suspicion that they participated in market manipulation on their own exchange. I think someone just tried to take advantage of Bitstamp as an underlying mechanism.
Right. But wouldn't Bitstamp therefore be incentivized if they see someone trying to abuse Bitstamp as a mechanism to protect their own interests and halt trading? We saw like Coinbase halted trading during the bull run.
In the heat of the moment, I think their systems took over and took the safeties that they had in place.
Right.
That's why that market order lasted several minutes instead of a few seconds.
Right.
Because it would have crashed the price further. I have no doubt that Bitstamp's engineering team has had many a meeting to figure out how could we better facilitate mass market trading like this where a whole bunch of, you know, coin goes for sale at once or whatever. But they're not going to try to get in the middle of a market and say, hey, this is not how it should be. It's wrong. They're not going to get in the middle of it during the fact. They'll try to review and continuously monitor the way that they handle issues moving forward so that it's a fair place to trade with high integrity, because that's what these exchanges want. And for whatever it's worth, I would just throw in out a few. Like, I would say that's probably true of Bitstamp, of Coinbase, of Kraken, and even Bitfinex and Binance. They want to be a place where you can trust them to do the right thing.
I would call that I always try to disagree with Jay at least a certain amount. I would call that a generous assessment of the intentions of those exchanges. I will acknowledge that some of those exchanges, that's true of. I will not go as far as to say all of those exchanges. I would say that the bottom half of those exchanges, without naming names, I think are out for themselves. And if they see a way to make a buck or to improve their own dominant situation, I actually think that's the bigger thing. I don't think it's so much about literally making money trading. I think it's about owning the market and owning share. I think that they're all pretty much like ethicsless when it comes to
that. But they would not want to do something that's going to hurt their customers, because they rely on their customers trusting them as a place to trade, because their customers are putting, you know, millions of dollars on their exchange, trusting them. So manipulating your own exchange is not good, manipulating someone else's exchange.
Don't shit where you eat, like go on someone else's exchange.
Yeah.
Well, that plays into our overall theory here, though, that like these exchanges are betting on other exchanges and are going to be like, oh, can you believe these fuckers trying to like wreck our long? Let's get them.
And more importantly, I might argue that perhaps there are individuals inside of an exchange that see weaknesses in an exchange and are able to use their funds to do stuff. But this is beyond, I wanted to talk about the game theory of the act itself.
Yes.
Trying to speculate who's the person that did it is beyond my ability to do so.
I understand. These are in a certain way unknowable things. Let me ask you for a prediction then.
Okay.
How mature does Bitcoin need to get before this kind of stuff gets rooted out? Like, how long are we going to be in the Wild West of market manipulation, do you think, on the Bitcoin markets?
Probably several more years. I would say like BitMEX in particular has such an outsized influence on the market. And as a derivatives exchange, it's a little dangerous for the derivatives exchange to be so much larger than any of the underlying platforms. This type of thing is much more difficult when the spot markets or the cash market exchanges are by far the dominant place to participate. So I think the derivatives markets need to be smaller than the cash markets, and that requires several things. But right now, for most of the world, they have chosen to use the derivatives markets to be their place of trading of choice. And as long as there's this high leverage with this many dollars on them, then the markets are ripe for this type of shenanigan.
Okay, let me ask you a binary question then.
Okay.
I know we're both Bitcoin fans. We're both rooting for Bitcoin, right?
Mm-hmm.
Would you rather have BitMEX and highly leveraged derivatives trading, knowing that it'll probably be like influenced in the longer term by manipulators, or a Bitcoin ETF? Like, let's say you can't have both.
Bitcoin ETF.
Yeah. Why don't we just get rid of all this derivatives trading? It's like clearly what's in the way.
So derivatives trading exists in all markets, though. It's not in the way. It's just
you can't ban it? Like what happened if BitMEX, say, got shut down?
If BitMEX got shut down, derivatives trading would happen in other places that are unregulated. And eventually, derivatives trading will occur, like it is now on CME, in places that are more typical, I guess, for that type of trading. You cannot get rid of derivatives trading, gamblers, and everything else. Like, that's...
Gambler's gonna gamble.
I mean, people do that in the equity markets too, you know? Like, there's people that trade synthetics that aren't actually the underlying equities, but they're trading them anyway, and they're shady gray market types of places. That will always exist. What will help the Bitcoin market is for a traditional place where, you know, the average Joe, like you or I, is willing to put our money, but it has all the same baseline features of a place like BitMEX, maybe with a little more sanity on a leverage point of view. For example, what if I could go to E-Trade or TD Ameritrade or Charles Schwab or like one of those big markets? And what if that market was 24/7, which is a huge downfall of CME in my mind? So what if that market was 24/7? And what if they did have traditional options trading and they had leverage, but maybe you can trade 2 to 4x, which is basically what you can do in the traditional stock market for someone with a regular old margin account.
I love how I'm like, hey, how can we get rid of all this risky gambling? And you're like, what if we could do this risky gambling more easily at a more reputable website?
Well, that's
I'm sure that's it's going to coming. I mean, why not?
It's coming on those markets. So yeah. The question will be, how do they expose their own derivatives products to those customers? I mean, they do it with stocks. As you know, like, someone can go on Robinhood and like sell options and then get margin called for tens of thousands of dollars because they had no idea what they were doing.
Yes.
To BitMEX's credit and any of the exchanges in the crypto market, they don't have margin calls in the sense that you have to go deposit new money. They just liquidate your position so that then you don't owe your whole life to them.
Right.
On these traditional markets, you can owe the exchanges, the brokers, lots of money. Like, they can take your house if you do the wrong thing. And that's available to retail traders. You can do it from an iPhone app with Robinhood. And that's very dangerous. So I think that these regulations are skewed and they're not really well built for retail in the first place. And some of the rules they do have don't make any sense. Like, in the US, in the stock market, if you have less than $25,000 in your account, you can't day trade at all. But you can buy weekly options that will almost certainly go to zero. So they'll let you lose your money really quickly, just they have certain rules around it.
Speaking of extreme gambling, how are your Hero tokens doing?
Oh, Hero has taken a hit, man, on the trading market.
Oh, they're down?
Oh, yeah. It went down quite a bit. I think someone actually, their hardware wallet got hacked and they market dumped some Hero and some other stuff. But Hero was illiquid enough that it affected the market dramatically. But that's okay. I paid nothing to get my Hero, and then I did very well. So I've done fine with my Hero. I'm a Hero hodler for what I have left, but I sold a little bit of it.
Speaking of depressed alts, which apparently I didn't know Hero was. Hero never really had it. Its glory days, I guess, were like before you could trade it. A story is all time.
When we talked last time,
oh, there was trading. It was already trading.
It was both on IDEX and on Bittrex International. Yeah. So it had a couple of listings, but it's pretty low volume.
I'm off of Bittrex. They kicked me off because I live in New York.
Yeah.
It's a dirty shame.
Classic.
I had to move my coins to something called Atomic Wallet or something. And then I was like, did I just download some wallet after Googling it? That's probably a scam. But apparently
it's
real.
You shouldn't say that on air.
Okay. We had a discussion on the show, I think last week or a couple weeks ago, where I was basically like, we've been dancing around the maximalist position, Bitcoin position, a lot for like the last year. And I think we declared 2018 the year of the Bitcoin maximalist. And so my bull argument about Bitcoin was basically, if you look at the entire crypto market and you take the Saifedean Amusian view that all coins except Bitcoin are shit coins and are going to zero. As a person who studies markets, does all of that value then flow to Bitcoin? Because if so, Bitcoin is massively undervalued right now.
I don't know that I'd say Bitcoin is massively undervalued right now. I also don't know that I would say altcoins are done because, you know, people want to increase their Bitcoin and they are lured to alts no matter what you try to do.
I like this take. I like that you always come, you and Kang have a certain essential similarity, which is like, what, you think people aren't going to gamble?
Right. I mean, if you tell someone, hey, look, this person over here, they bought one Bitcoin and then they bought this altcoin called Verge or Ripple, and then they had 10 Bitcoin after they were done. Like, that will always have a draw to people. So the problem is there are too many altcoins, and there's obviously zero barrier to entry to creating new ones. So I actually think that there's a ticker called like Total and Total 2 on TradingView, but it's basically the market cap of altcoins and then of altcoins plus Bitcoin. You can also see these on the websites like CoinMarketCap, and there's better ones like OnChainFX. Anyway, Bitcoin dominance is pretty high right now, but 2017 really created like a altcoin extravaganza, like the first couple months of 2018, actually.
Super airdrop festival, if you will.
Yeah, the super airdrop festival took Bitcoin dominance down to like 40%, and now Bitcoin dominance is around 60%. Before that, Bitcoin dominance was always like 80% plus.
Right.
So we could go, if we went back to like normal, we could go to Bitcoin dominance getting upwards of 80%. I personally think that that probably won't happen, if for no other reason, because there's always so many altcoins and they have these supposed supplies, but they're so illiquid that that's what the zombie token thing is that I've described before.
Yes.
So like, even if the altcoin market cap is, you know, battling against Bitcoin well enough, and, you know, maybe it goes up and Bitcoin loses some dominance, that doesn't necessarily mean it's going to go to your alts. Like, it could go to the alt flavor of the month, and then there's graveyards worth of altcoins that didn't pump and all that kind of stuff. So it's still a dangerous game.
Well, I think about that with regards to my Sumo bag, where it's like Cryptopia has been shut down.
Yeah, Sumo's gone, man.
Those coins are stuck on Cryptopia. Sumo is still traded on some other exchange.
Sure.
But my coins are stuck on Cryptopia, and they are counted in the overall total two or whatever as part of the market cap of overall crypto. But I can assure you they're worth zero. Like, their actual value is zero. So I guess that would either suggest that the overall market cap of crypto is inflated by a lot of, like, dead token weight, or you could say that's value that's just waiting to accrue to the stuff at the top, which is sort of philosophically how I'm starting to think of it. I feel pretty bullish about Bitcoin right now, and I actually feel bullish about, like, the alts that are traded on Coinbase right now. It seems to me like there's a certain amount of value that's locked in the, let's say, below the 50% market of overall market cap coins among the entire range. All of that value is starting to seem like pretty dead zombie tokenish to me.
Yes. And there will be stuff that 100 or 1,000x is out of the graveyard. Maybe it's something that comes back to life. Maybe it's some brand new token that started at zero. But for the most part, when I'm looking at this, I look at Bitcoin and every now and then some other coin as investments. I look at any altcoin as a trade.
Yep.
So it's not that I won't participate, but you're going to have a hard time convincing me why I should hold it for a long time or dollar cost average in a significant way into it. Whereas with Bitcoin, of all of the cryptocurrency market, I believe in Bitcoin in an investment vehicle and as a pretty darn good hedge to the end of the world, as y'all have talked about. So if all the main currencies of the world go to crap, one of the most interesting things we saw of your Reddit theories, the one that I liked a lot, is the fact of fear and Chinese capital flight and unknowing what's going to happen with the yuan and the dollar. That coincided with the Bitcoin move up pretty strongly.
Yeah.
And I wonder if, because of the relatively small size of Bitcoin's market cap, et cetera, it made it lend itself well to going up in the uncertainty of those currency markets.
You could also say that if you look at the road between now and November 2020, expect turbulence, America, you know?
Yeah.
And like, if you're just like, I track Bitcoin entirely by American fear, I'm like, yeah, it's going to be a great time for American fear over the next year.
Yeah, between the U.S. election, between Bitcoin's halving, between the state of the traditional markets and the slowing economy, like, I think Bitcoin's a fantastic hedge.
China, Iran, North Korea, there's tons of turbulence opportunities out there.
Yeah, I think there's a really good argument to be made for Bitcoin. And it may be relative to some other currencies. Like, it may not be relative to the dollar. Like, the dollar could be okay, but I mean, interest rates are still negative in Europe. Like, what if we have a significant recession? Like, what are they going to do? You know, like, where is the market for yield in the real world?
I generally don't engage in Austrian school economics on the show, but I saw a tweet that was, if you bought Bitcoin at the high with Argentinian pesos, you are up money right now.
Yeah. And people were doing that. I've actually talked to a couple people from there and heard podcasts with
them. We hear so much about how dangerous Bitcoin is. The peso, the Argentinian peso, was much more dangerous over that time period on the basis of its inflation, which increasingly makes me look outside of America, where I'm just like, I think that the narrative of Bitcoin, if it ever really approaches a maximalist view, is going to start with the world's lower 50% stable currencies. Which is a lot of currencies, you know? There's only like a few stable currencies. Most of the currencies are not very stable.
Yes, and someone that lives in a place where that's where their primary income is made, they see the risks better than we do as Americans. So I think that we're spoiled. And if you combine a lot of those markets. And some of those folks say, you know what, for me, it's a great hedge to be in Bitcoin. Yep. If they're putting 10% of their salary or 20% of their salary into Bitcoin, holding it there and then only moving it out when they have to buy things, like, that's enormously bullish for Bitcoin. And I think that's a real world possibility.
I agree. Especially if you allowed people to manage their finances algorithmically. So if you were to just say, adjust for inflation in the moves, always hold a certain percentage of my money in like crypto and a certain percent in, say, the Argentinian peso, and just like let the app create like the most opportunistic way to manage that. I mean, you already see parts of the world where people are managing their bank account in cell phone minutes. So people are willing to get pretty creative and are in pretty dire situations. I don't know what percentage of the world lives in a like bad currency inflation situation, but it wouldn't shock me to learn that half of the world lives in a problematic currency situation.
Or more, other than the fact that almost any of those places, if you hand them $20 instead of $20 worth of whatever they have in their native currency, they'll say, okay, I'll take that dollar.
Yeah.
But if my thing is, if Bitcoin can be some form of safe haven asset for them that they have greater or some degree of trust in addition to their own currency, and then very important to this to me is the Lightning Network or something like it is successful, then that gives Bitcoin a great opportunity to fulfill Jack Dorsey's vision of being the money of the internet. As an e-commerce person, like the fees, the lack of fees through the Lightning Network, that can really transform the way people transact online, the way small transactions work. You're solving the fee problem with Bitcoin, basically, if the Lightning Network or something like it works.
Which is kind of back to the Satoshi original vision, which was basically like, fuck PayPal.
Yes, and you're creating a really impressive argument there, for, in my opinion, for being bullish Bitcoin in combination with all of your turbulent thesis for the world. So yes, I'm looking at Bitcoin as an investment. I'm unwilling to look at that as like a thing that has a chance, but you can make an economic argument for it and then pull up something else. I don't care what it is. I don't care if it's Ethereum. I don't care if it's Tezos, EOS, certainly not Bitcoin Cash or any of those things. Any altcoin, it might do better than that argument for a hot minute, and I might be willing to trade it for that purpose, but I don't think I'm willing to put it together for the next year, 2 years, 3 years, and treat that as a long-term investment like I'm willing to do with Bitcoin.
Okay, my last question, Ledger.
All right.
I feel like my biggest mistake during the last bull run was like doing exactly what you said, buying alongside the moving bus. Where I was like, I want to put more money in, which eventually led me to buy significant portions of Bitcoin above $10,000, which was a mistake. So this time I'm just holding my position. I was just looking right now. We're sitting just under $8,000 Bitcoin. Mm-hmm. Will you be buying Bitcoin, let's say above $10,000, if it should happen? If the next jump gets us up around $10,000, like what's the highest amount that you're comfortable buying Bitcoin for?
If I'm buying at 10,000, it's because we've already breached 10,000 and we're consolidating back to 10,000.
Yeah.
To me right now, if we hit 9,600, that level that I was talking about earlier, I will be a no-coiner for a bit. I'm a coiner today. Around 8,200, I was a no-coiner. I'm playing it pretty tight right now. Like we're at the top end of the trading range, and we're due for some consolidation, even if it doesn't mean we go way lower. I want to be more careful about where I'm buying, because the risk for a down move, you know, we painted down there with the wick from a Bitstamp shenanigan, 6,400 to 6,800, depending on the exchange we're looking at. We did that temporarily. I think there's a very good chance that we revisit that territory and have some kind of consolidation. Whether we've topped out and the 8,200 weekly close was the highest we'll get, or whether we get hyped up again and go up to that other 96, maybe 10K level, I don't know. I have to play that on the lower time frames. But I do think that we'll see 6,000 something Bitcoin again. So I'm in a zone of caution at the moment. So the only way I would do that is if we go to like 12K and then we consolidate
right.
there.
You're only buying a $10,000 dip situation.
Correct.
Thank you so much, Ledger. Where can people find you? What are you pushing right now? What's your number one push?
Just go to ledgerstatus.com. We're putting out episodes as well. We talked about this Bitstamp thing basically the day it happened.
Ledger hosts a podcast with Carpe Noctem. It's great. If you enjoy like the kind of stuff we were just talking about, except much more intelligent because I'm not there, subscribe to the Ledgercast.
Thank you.
The podcast app you are currently listening to.
And keep listening to this because it's still the most fun podcast in crypto.
Thank you. Come back soon.
All right, buddy. Bye.
This episode of Coin Talk was taped Monday, May 20th at 11 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. The Bitcoin price index was $7,751.
That was Coin Talk. Thanks very much to our editor, James Nicholson. Thanks to our partners over at Medium. Thanks to my co-host, Jay Kang. I'll be back soon. We love all the lightning tips we've been getting. You can go to Tippin, tippin.me/@CoinTalkShow. You can always send us an email, hi@cointalk.show. Be back next week.